Hello, and welcome to the 538 Politics Podcast. I'm Galen Druk. It's been a week since George Floyd died after a police officer kneeled on his neck for more than 8 minutes in Minneapolis. The week has been filled with peaceful protests against police violence across the country, as well as violent exchanges with police and looting. President Trump initially called for justice for George Floyd's family and has since focused on the looting and violence, tweeting that, quote, "When the looting starts, the shooting starts," end quote. Floyd's death comes after the high-profile killings of two other Black Americans, Ahmaud Arbery and Breonna Taylor, the latter also by police. It also comes amid a global pandemic and record-high unemployment, both of which have disproportionately affected African-American communities. It's a moment perhaps unlike any other in recent U.S. history. And so today, we're going to try to describe this moment, both in terms of the data behind police violence and how this is all interacting with our already fraught politics. Here with me to do that are Editor-in-Chief Nate Silver. Hey, Nate.
Hey, Galen.
Also here with us is Senior Politics Writer Claire Malone. Hey, Claire.
Hi, Galen.
And also joining us is Sam Sinyangwe. Sam is a data analyst and co-founder of Campaign Zero, a group that advocates for policies to eliminate police violence. Hey, Sam. Thanks for being with us.
It's good to be here.
And also, as of today, Sam is a 538 contributor. He wrote for the site about the trend in police violence in the U.S. over the last few years. Essentially, while the number of people killed by police has been relatively flat nationally, that steadiness masks some important changes underneath the surface. So we're going to dig into that. But before we get into the specifics of the police violence data, this seems like a notable moment in American history. And so I want to start off by trying to describe what's happening right now. What are the different emotions, forces, politics at play that got us to this moment? Claire, do you want to kick us off?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's been quite a week. And so I think it's the forces that have led to this moment are, you know, hundreds of years old, right? With the racial history of the United States, but obviously in the more recent history, America has been under a lockdown much of America has been under a lockdown for the past couple of months. This killing of George Floyd by police that was videotaped and sort of has been unambiguously accepted by, sort of astoundingly for our partisan moment, by the right and the left as this huge miscarriage of justice. And we've obviously seen protests, some peaceful, some violent at times throughout the United States. I mean, I'm in Brooklyn and, you know, saw the riots in Flatbush kind of firsthand, or the police presence around them. Have spent the last two nights hearing helicopters everywhere. So, you know, I know I certainly am seeing it online everywhere, but also in real life, as I think a lot of Americans are, particularly in larger cities. So it's a pretty raw emotional moment for the country.
Yeah. Sam, how are you making sense of the forces behind this moment?
You know, I view this as the culmination of frustration and anger and a sense of profound injustice that has been building really since 2014, since Mike Brown was shot and killed by police in Ferguson, sparking a movement that has been calling for police accountability. And since then, we've just seen, you know, video after video after video of police violence responded to by protest after protest after protest. And there is this sense that it just keeps going on and on. And when is this going to end? I think that coupled with so many of the factors that you talked about, Claire, the lockdown, the fact that so many people are out of work and out of school, the fact that so many people are hurting economically, I think all of that sort of builds into the moment that we're in, coupled with the exacerbation of things often by, you know, the president and, you know, when the looting starts, the shooting starts and all of these sort of inflammatory statements. So you put all that together and you get a moment where in, you know, dozens of cities across the country, you essentially have an open rebellion against state power and the police. And, you know, this is a moment that is all too familiar for so many of us.
How is this similar or different to the Black Lives Matter protests that began 6 years ago, as you mentioned? Should we consider this just a piece of that, or is something fundamentally different here?
I think it is the same fight, the same goals, and the same issues that are being protested in terms of police violence, racism. But I think what is interesting about this moment is, you know, now we are 6 years into this. So a lot of the people who are out in the streets today were actually quite young in 2014. There's a generational difference where a lot of folks who may have been in high school are now sort of experiencing in their lives this sense that, you know, I've been seeing this ever since I was a kid, and now this is still going on. Now I want to do something about this. I just saw a tweet yesterday that a lot of the people who were, you know, in school when George Zimmerman was acquitted for killing Trayvon Martin, they grew up under this sort of looming cloud of racism and state violence and injustice and all of the political consciousness that's been built over the past 6 years to help people understand that and process that and react to that. I think that's what we're seeing now as a continuation, but it's also there are some different folks involved now. It's an expansion beyond where we were in 2014.
The idea that this is a maturation of that movement, I think is pretty dead on, but it's a maturation of a protest movement for sure. But also I think what's interesting about this particular killing and the protests that have followed is it seems like, well, A, it's sort of this unambiguous, everyone's seen the video footage, it's pretty clear. You know, in Ferguson, there was a ton of, you know, the days after the killing of Michael Brown, there was a lot of controversy about, well, what really happened? Was he, you know, there was basically ambiguity. And here, there's no ambiguity, right? So it sort of takes that part of things away from it. But what's been interesting for me to watch is police violence in America and protests, including sometimes violent protests or looting, is this like really complicated dynamic that I think in previous waves of protests has sort of been missed a bit by the broader narrative. Now we're only a couple days into this, but I do think that there's been a lot more nuanced narrative about it in newspapers, on social media. Frankly, you see a lot more white people involved in the protests. You see a lot more the thing I'm thinking about is Instagram influencers, right? Like over the past 3 days, you know, it started off, there were a few celebrities or influencers who did like fashion or lifestyle who were kind of saying like, here's anti-racist resources. And over the past 2 days, even the kind of most apolitical people have started posting these things, which I think is really fascinating. And it's sort of this, I mean, I think Instagram operates by this law of kind of like peer pressure, but it's almost like there's this anti-racist, I would say, socially good peer pressure on Instagram, which has been interesting to watch because I think it's indicative of kind of the country at a little bit of a different, perhaps more receptive or empathetic moment. So I think the conversation, at least thus far, has been, it's felt different. It's felt a little bit more empathetic, and maybe that's the particular moment we're in.
I mean, I do want to offer some grounding, given that this is 538 in public opinion, about how the general public sees what's going on, because I think it's different than some of the discourse among reporters on Twitter, say. But Yahoo News and YouGov asked, how would you describe the protests in Minneapolis, mostly peaceful protests, mostly violent riots, or about an equal mix? And 51% of people said mostly violent riots, 10% said mostly peaceful protests, about 25% said a mix. So if you're watching cable news, you probably are not seeing that much about the protests, and you're probably seeing a lot about the looting, maybe also something about how police are behaving toward protesters and toward the media and whatever else, right? But you're seeing something that's being portrayed as destructive and violent.
For sure. Nate, I take your point, but let me push back a little bit here. And I agree we need grounding in data. But I think that when I bring up like Instagram influencers or some of the narratives on this, we talk about this a lot. Like media narratives are important, and sort of the top line narratives, even if they're different in different parts of the media, are pretty ultimately important for events like this that unfold on people's phone screens or newspaper headlines or, as you say, cable. So it is, I think it is important to talk about both the polling numbers and where people's, you know, people's perceptions of protests as violent versus peaceful. But I also think it's important to talk about, there are top notes that are different, I think, in the media coverage of this so far. So I take your point, but also want to say, like, it's both.
No, I agree. And I'm trying to remember back to, you know, when I was a kid and you kind of see coverage of like the Rodney King riots or whatever, right? And it certainly seems different, but I'm recalling my recollection from being a, you know, young teenager or whatever, so it's a little hard. But I am saying, like, a great number of stories, there may be a gap between how the four of us are interpreting news coverage and the average person who flicks on CNN or Fox News or whatever might be getting a different taste on them. I mean, the other thing that's complicated is, like, whenever you are describing what's happening, what's the language you're supposed to use to describe it? And, I mean, the complicated part of it is, like, it's a bunch of things happening at once. It's largely peaceful protests. And connected to that, but not actually that connected to that, you have violence taking place. And kind of that violence itself probably draws on a lot of elements, maybe a few of which does involve people who are kind of putatively in the protests, but do not necessarily actually get what those protests are about. But also, maybe there also are people who are just kind of there to be destructive, or are just there to be kind of gawkers and tourists. It's a bunch of stuff happening at once. It's very hard to figure out kind of what's going on. And so protest slash unrest slash riots is like a way to describe it, but recognize it doesn't mean that it's like that there's one thing that's both a protest and a riot. There are two things that are happening at once, and we can debate kind of exactly how much or not overlap they have. But, you know, I know our reporters, other reporters in Minneapolis, for example, have been saying, hey, look, increasingly there have been fewer actual protests because people are now saying, look, these have become violent, right? And the places where the protests are and the places where the violence and looting are not the same parts of the city. And so it's just important that, like, I always want to complicate things, I guess.
Well, of course. I mean, it is complicated. And we've seen reporting that both far left and far right activists or agitators are responsible for some of the violence. And of course, at this moment, only a week in, it's hard to make sense of exactly what is going on. So let's acknowledge that. But I also want to get Sam, you in here. How are you viewing the relationship between the peaceful protests and some of these skirmishes with police or vandalizing, setting things on fire, etc.?
Yeah, I mean, I think it is complicated. Clearly, these have been largely peaceful protests. At the same time, I think we've seen a bit of property damage as well. And I think the word violence is sort of, so the language, again, as you were saying, Nate, is important. So is it a riot or is it an uprising or a rebellion, right? And I think in history, you look at like the Boston Tea Party, well, that was a bunch of looting, and that would be described as a violent protest if that were happening today. And yet in the history books, it's sort of this patriotic expression of the colonists' need for democracy and rebellion against, you know, the British. So again, language is important. I think the media in general has tended to describe them as violent protests. But the videos that I've seen, most of the videos where I see actual violence against people, it's being committed by the police. So, you know, it is interesting, when we think about, you know, who is committing most of the violence, who gets blamed, or how do we frame what's happening and where the violence is happening. There clearly are people who are joining these protests, and I've seen plenty of videos online just of people who are being told to stop, you know, to not do this. And they, you know, tend to just be coming in and causing damage that local community folks, including local protesters, haven't really supported and are trying to stop. So, there are a lot of people out there. This is happening in dozens of cities. So there will be complications and nuance that I think we have to unpack.
What does police violence look like today in America? How common is it? How fatal is it? What role does race play? This is your area of expertise. You wrote about this for the site today. Paint us a data-driven picture of what police violence looks like.
Yeah, so just to back up and get into the data a little bit. First of all, in 2014, we didn't know a whole lot about the data around police violence. The reason for that is the federal government, even to this day, does not collect comprehensive data on people who are killed by the police, let alone all of these other forms of police violence that are non-fatal, but also cause quite a bit of damage. Now, that has been pretty well rectified through a range of different projects. You know, we launched Mapping Police Violence in early 2015, which is a database of people killed by the police. The Washington Post launched their database a few months later. Fatal Encounters is a database that's been around that is really strong and includes things that neither of those databases include around suicides during a police encounter, people who are killed in police pursuits, and a range of other aspects of policing that we otherwise wouldn't be able to track. But the data tells a story of what's happened over the past 6 years. And that story is complicated. It is, when you look at the national trend line, what you see is year after year after year, a similar number of people have been killed by police in the United States. So it has been about 1,100 people a year. And so in a given year, you might have in between 1,000 and maybe 1,300 people killed by police, depending on the database. Now, Fatal Encounters has a little bit more, but again, that includes suicides and things that are not really the police directly killing people. So the trend line hasn't really gone down. And I think that is also a factor here. I think a lot of people are seeing after 6 years of mass protests, of a lot of politicians and influencers and researchers spending a lot of time to unpack these issues and talk about them in different ways than we were talking about them in 2013. When you look at the numbers, it looks like things aren't really getting better. And I think that that is fundamentally frustrating to a lot of people. However, I think when you do a deeper dive in the numbers, which is what this article is about, what's fascinating about it is that you see differences depending on geography. So in cities, particularly the largest cities in the country, you're seeing a reduction in killings by police and overall police shootings, both fatal and non-fatal, over time. So in the Mapping Police Violence database, there is a 30% reduction in killings by police from 2013 to 2019. In the Washington Post database, which tracks from 2015 through 2019, they have a 17% reduction.
And that's only in big cities?
Yeah, so that's in the 30 largest cities in America. Now, when we look at what's happening outside of those cities, though, we're seeing that the rates are actually increasing, that in suburban and rural communities, rates of police violence have actually been going up. So that is offsetting the reductions that we're seeing in cities. So that's a complicated dynamic, but what it suggests is that in some places, they're finding ways to reduce police violence, even though they haven't brought it down to zero. We're talking about, a 30% reduction is fairly substantial. But in other places, that is not happening. Right, and the opposite, in fact, is happening. So there's a complicated narrative here. And part of what's fascinating about it is to try to unpack the why behind the data. So what explains the reduction in both killings and non-fatal shootings by police in major American cities? And what explains that increase in urban and rural areas? And I think those questions are fundamental to improving our understanding about how to address this issue nationwide.
And Sam, do we have any theories about why that's the case in suburban and rural areas? For instance, is it that more minorities are moving into those areas? You know, you can say there's an influx of Latinos into places in the South that have meat processing plants where there weren't typically as many minorities. Or is it something a little harder to put our finger on with data where it's perhaps police in cities that maybe don't have the same kind of, let's say, democratic administrations that are pushed by their constituents to have police reform, those police in those areas are reacting to, frankly, the national conversation around police violence changing a little bit and perhaps are having like a defensive or defiant reaction?
Yeah, so demographic change is a fascinating thing to explore here, because that was what I thought when I saw the rates going up in suburban and rural areas. As you mentioned, both Black and Latino communities are increasingly being pushed out of cities as sort of the rent goes way up and into the suburbs and into rural areas to a lesser extent than the suburbs. So I thought, maybe that is why we're seeing the rates of police violence go up. As we know, looking at the data, Black people are three times more likely to be killed per population than white people by police, and are more likely to be unarmed and a whole range of other factors. But when you look at the data, it's not clear that that's what explains this. In the suburbs, we're seeing an increase in Latinos that are being killed by police over time. But again, the population is also changing, so you would expect that the composition of those being killed by police would reflect the population to some extent as it changes. But in rural areas, the increase is actually increasing among white people who are being killed by the police, in particular, white people who are armed with a gun. So it's like a fascinating, you know, this might have to do with the opioid crisis. It might have to do with higher rates of gun deaths and suicides in general in rural areas over this time. There are a range of factors. I'm not sure what explains that in particular, but those might be some areas to explore.
On the flip side, can we say why the rates have gone down in big cities? And is it because of policy? If so, then do we have a clear sense of what policies do actually reduce police violence?
Yeah, so the rates have gone down in big cities. Importantly, they've gone down for all races. So, you know, this is not purely explained by, let's say, like gentrification and cities, you know, particularly cities becoming more white. In fact, this is being explained by what appears to be a set of reforms that have been adopted by the largest cities in particular that have sought to curb police use of force in response to the protests. One of the things that we know after 6 years of this work and research and data collection, we've looked at the range of proposed reforms that have been offered around police violence. One of the projects that we did in 2016 was called the Use of Force Project, where we looked at the use of force policies of the 100 largest cities in the country. And what we found was that there were a set of policies that were associated with lower rates of police-involved killings. So departments that required officers to use de-escalation were less likely to kill people. Departments that banned chokeholds and strangleholds were less likely to kill people. Departments that required officers to use every alternative available to them prior to using deadly force were less likely to kill people. So that builds off of 30 years of academic research that has consistently come to the conclusion that more restrictive standards around use of force predict lower rates of police shootings overall and killings by police in particular. Now, when I talk about these policies, it sort of doesn't sound really radical, you know, requiring officers to use de-escalation when they can, requiring officers to use alternatives to deadly force when they can, you know, not choking people or strangling people. These are fairly common sense. But in our analysis, what we found was that the majority of police departments, for example, do not require de-escalation in their use of force policies. The majority of departments do not require officers to use alternatives to deadly force whenever possible in their policies. And only 28 of the 100 largest cities ban chokeholds and other neck restraints. So these are a set of policies that are sort of common sense. Some departments have adopted them already. And what we found in this analysis when we did the deeper dive is that many of those departments that had the largest reductions over time, departments like Chicago, departments like Baltimore, departments like Phoenix, have implemented one or more of those types of reforms. So this helps to establish the efficacy of some of the reforms that have been implemented. However, you know, this is something that is a complicated issue. There is not sort of one sort of magic bullet or silver bullet solution, but it looks that there are some solutions that can make a difference that have been implemented, particularly in larger cities, and that might provide a roadmap for how we can affect this issue nationwide.
Have you looked at how different rates of violence are connected to the racial composition of the police forces in different places?
So this has been a topic of considerable inquiry over the past 6 years. You know, based on the research that has been produced to date, there's not strong evidence that changing the demographics of the police department with regard to race significantly impacts rates of police violence. There is a study by Columbia University Professor Jeffrey Fagan, who produced a study that showed that while modest changes in the demographics of police departments didn't seem to make a difference, they did make an impact in reducing killings of Black civilians when a department got to a threshold of 35% of the police force being Black or more. So what that speaks to, and you look at polling data that's been done over the years by Pew, and what they found, they actually surveyed officers across the country. And they found that Black officers are significantly more likely to believe that there is a need for reform to believe that there is a systemic issue in policing. So by fundamentally changing the demographics of the police force, and again, I mean, not modest, but really talking about, you know, almost a majority or more of the police force being Black, that can shift the culture of the department and make the department more likely to implement the types of changes that can make a difference.
You know, it's interesting. Obama put out his kind of first statement on all of this, and it was through a post on Medium. And he basically talks about the need for local police reforms that are tailored to specific communities, which I thought was an interesting response and also a very Obama-esque response. But, you know, while Sam has been talking, it's you know, about the idea of de-escalation in departments that have a greater focus on de-escalation to see lower rates, which perhaps makes sense of police killings. You know, it's interesting to think in this whole debate that everything we're kind of talking about, I heard someone on the radio use this phrase this weekend, that this is basically about the state monopoly on violence, right? And a lot of the country's politics actually come down to that, right? We talk about Second Amendment rights, we talk about police killings. And I've been thinking about that phrase, state monopoly on violence, which, you know, this person was saying the police have. And I was thinking about a line that Joe Biden, a portion of his stump speech that Joe Biden has about, you know, with Second Amendment rights, people say we need to sort of be able to have arms to defend ourselves against the state. Obviously, as we've seen over the past couple of days, the state has more firepower than individual citizens. So it's interesting to watch these kind of big picture, 30,000 feet up things play out in the idea of, you know, it makes sense that people want de-escalation from their police force because they understand that their police force has the monopoly on more guns, more organization, right? More people sort of being out in front of them. So it's interesting to watch these kind of like what are often academicized or more obtuse debates that we're having kind of winnow down into what does it actually look like to be conscious, A, that you have basically the monopoly on violence, which I think is pretty true. I mean, you saw Tom Cotton, a senator, obviously, tweeting today that perhaps the U.S. military should be put out into the streets of America, not just the National Guard, right? So people are very conscious of the fact right now, I think, that there is, again, this social contract and that they do not have as much power as the state, and they expect the state to regulate itself when it comes to the use of that violence. So the idea, going back to how do very specific policies of, you know, officer de-escalation and, you know, people have been talking a lot about, should the police have the kind of gear that they have? Should they have the physical presence? You know, the way they look on the streets is pretty militarized. I think you're starting to see a lot of that stuff bubble up in these conversations. And a lot of it does come down to, if we all agree the state has a monopoly on violence, how are they supposed to regulate themselves? And I think pretty much most Americans from all political spectrums can acknowledge the fact that, like, we're not living in the 1800s and a farmer rebellion from, you know, North Carolina can't really, you know, take on the U.S. military or the National Guard or, frankly, even their local police force.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. You know, it's and this is what we see in the research that's been done over the past 6 years from so many different professors and activists and organizers. You know, there's research now, multiple studies that are showing that the departments that get the most military weapons from the federal government through the Department of Defense's 1033 program, that those are the police departments that have higher rates of police-involved killings. You know, this is, it's sort of common sense, and it's fascinating because I think the issue of policing is treated differently than other issues. So, you know, nobody says that standards don't matter in education, for example. But in policing, it's this question of, well, like, do the standards and policies even matter? Should they have higher or more restrictive standards? Or is it just the culture of the police department and they're going to do whatever they do anyway? And, you know, I think standards matter in every sector, in every industry. But at the same time, you know, this is something where it's less a question of what works, because now we know a little bit more about what works. It's the standards. It's making sure that they're enforced with accountability structures. It's not having militarized police forces. It's more a question of political will. And I think to date, we haven't seen particularly bipartisan political will to take on these issues. I think that might be changing now because we're seeing, I mean, you know, police chiefs, we're seeing Justin Amash just proposed a bill that would end qualified immunity for officers. So it would allow people to sue them in court for misconduct. and win, because right now qualified immunity really severely restricts your likelihood of prevailing in those cases. So I think there might be a chance here for a little bit more movement in Congress and in state capitol buildings and in city councils to address these issues based on research in a way that we just didn't see in 2014. I think in 2014, we were sort of flying blind. People were proposing things, but there was no data to evaluate them. So people were saying, well, body cameras, maybe body cameras will be a big deal. Well, the research that's been done since then has shown that, body cameras don't reduce use of force. People were saying implicit bias training. Well, there's no research establishing that implicit bias training reduces police use of force or racial disparities. So I think now there's a laser focus. There's an opportunity to use data in a different way to shift people towards evidence-based practices that have actually worked in some jurisdictions to address this issue. And I'm hopeful that knowledge and our ability to share that data can make a difference here.
I want to move on and talk about how this all interacts with the fraught political environment that we already have in this country, the fact that it's an election year. But first, today's podcast is brought to you by Audible. Audible is the leading provider of spoken word entertainment and audiobooks, ranging from bestsellers to celebrity memoirs to news and business. As communities around the world confront new challenges, including social distancing and school closures, everyone has an immediate need to try to relax and stay entertained. Audible believes that stories can help. If you're thinking about getting an Audible membership, now is the best time to do it with a special offer of 46% off for 4 whole months. That's all summer long. Right now, for a limited time, you can get 4 months of Audible for just $7.95 a month. That's almost 50% off for the entire summer. So treat yourself to a sweet deal that will last all summer long, and it ends June 15th. To get that offer, go to audible.com/538. Again, that's audible.com/538, or text 538, the numbers, to 500-500. Again, that's 538 to 500-500. Today's podcast is also brought to you by Casper. Years of research, hundreds of tests, thousands of iterations. The result, the latest and dreamiest in sleep innovation. Introducing the new mattresses from Casper. Waking up with back pain? Now they have zoned support. Casper's unique ergonomic system designed to keep your spine aligned while you sleep. There's also something brand new called the Airscape, which is engineered from foam layers with perforations to help regulate your sleep temperature. From bedding, bed frames, and even a dog bed, Casper has everything to build the dream bedroom for every kind of sleeper. Now Casper is offering free contactless delivery in addition to, as always, free shipping and free returns. Go to Casper.com and use code 538 for $100 off your mattress order. That's code 538, the numbers, not the letters, for $100 off your mattress order. Terms and conditions apply. See Casper.com/terms. So far in 2020, it's felt like every month we confront a different issue that could upend our politics and the 2020 election campaign. And clearly, June is no different. So, I know, Claire, you've written about this over the weekend. In what ways does this focus now on police violence and racial disparities, along with the mayhem in American cities, kind of change the themes of the 2020 election from what we expected just a few weeks ago?
Yeah, I wrote on Friday, which was after the first night of protesting, about Trump's law and order instincts. And when I say law and order, that's Trump's language, right? And also language that harkens back to, Nixon, Trump's favorite president, which is about, the idea that in 2016, a lot of Trump's language about in the good old days, or things used to be this way, we need law and order again, right? Trump has found a lot of success in the last election gearing up support from his base, and I think a lot of people who were sort of previously apathetic about politics, to talk about this idea of law and order, which I think is a dog whistle, the way Trump uses it, for a certain kind of social order that I think is this kind of nostalgic mid-century, things used to be orderly and good in America. And I think the past couple of days have probably turn this into, this was always going to be a racialized election because, that was what 2016 was. And the amount of violence that we're seeing in some of the protests and the way that violence is being talked about immediately plays into, I think, some of Trump's language around I don't quite know how to put this, but I guess a misdirection about where some of the anger and the protest is coming from. So, you know, while we've seen a lot of stuff about, you know, these are protests about George Floyd's death, you know, this is a miscarriage of justice, and we've seen that from people on the right, including, you know, Trump has sort of nodded to that he thinks that the officers were at fault. You've also seen a lot of talk about, well, these are protests that are being fomented by Antifa, which is the name for it's an umbrella term for a group. It's not really an organized group because they're anarchists, but they're sort of anti-fascist, right? So it has its roots in first in Europe, and then it kind of started, got hold in the U.S. and sort of the Pacific Northwest, and has become over the past 4 years this kind of radical anti-racist activist group that does sometimes use violent anti-state or anti-police action. And you see some of the conversation morphing into, from the Trump team, Antifa are running these protests, and you know the Biden campaign and the Democrats want you to donate to bail funds to bail out the violent Antifa activists. Is this the America that you want to live in, right? And that kind of plays into Trump's law and order stance, right? Where it is, do you want to see your cities burning? No, you know, I, Trump, will sort of restore order. I'm not sure how well that message rings in 2020, given that we are over 100,000 people dead in America from COVID-19, given the fact that Trump has seen, you know, plummeting poll numbers, you know, not so great approval ratings, and a call from a lot of people on the right, frankly, that he hasn't handled the situation well. And I think, you know, he hasn't made public statements about the riots this weekend. There is this kind of vacuum of leadership. And so this is, I'll stop rambling in a second, but I think it's this real, Trump's instinct is law and order. It's like his one heartfelt political belief. You can go back and read his Central Park 5 advertisement that he took out in U.S. papers about police brutality and the need for law and order. And you can kind of see how that doesn't quite jibe with the moment that we're in necessarily.
I mean, so it kind of feels like we're ignoring an elephant in the room here, which is that there's still a deadly pandemic that's killed 100,000 Americans and counting. And how do the protests and coronavirus reverberate off of one another?
I did mention that, but yeah.
No, I know, but like I'm saying, like, so for one thing, I'm not necessarily convinced, I don't know, I'm not convinced, which is hedging my bets a bit, that the protests will, in the long run, remove coronavirus from being the most important story of the 2020 campaign. Because there's no quick snap your fingers solution to any of this, right? But like, if you look at the timelines historically of, if you want to call them riots, right, civil unrest or protest movements, right, they are usually measured in shorter time frames than the time frame that people are projecting for coronavirus still being a part of our lives for at least another year or something, right? And so, you know, how has this changed the politics around coronavirus and Trump are things that I think are important to keep in mind. With that said, I mean, this seems very basic, right? But the basic idea that, hey, things are falling apart, and when things are falling apart, I am not happy with the president and the leadership of the country, on a basic level, that seems like it's quite bad for Trump. I mean, I don't know. I mean, this is one of the most difficult times for America, I would think, of my lifetime. I'm 42, with crises piling on top of one another. I don't know.
right. I mean, that's what my piece was about on Friday, right? Is that the disorder of the country makes it hard to run as a law and order person who says, I will restore order, because you spent the last 2 months sort of, there's a power vacuum of leadership in the country, I think a lot of people think. And Trump, as the law and order candidate, hasn't really fulfilled the order part when it comes to the pandemic. So I think you see a lot of people, you know, maybe ripping the seams open and seeing like, well, what's in here? It's his stuff is ringing a bit hollower than it would have.
Right. If there's a different administration currently governing America and you're the outsider Trump candidate, you can say, I will restore law and order. But when the right. lack of law and order is going on under your own administration, you have to first come up with a reason for why it's not your fault in the eyes of the American public. On the other hand here, we have, this is a challenging question for Democrats because they have to, you know, maybe this is just a referendum on Trump and maybe it matters less, but Biden has to now make his case and respond and talk about why he's a better option for both restoring law and order and restoring race relations and dealing with police violence. Sam, what is your interpretation of how Democrats and Biden in particular have gone about trying to establish themselves on all of those issues?
Yeah, it's been really hard for Democrats, you know, because in part, you know, some of the Democrats who are, you know, most prominent in consideration for the VP slots of people like Amy Klobuchar, you know, she's taking a lot of heat because she refused to prosecute that officer, Derek Chauvin, who then killed George Floyd. Right. We're looking at H.R. 1154, which is a bill in Congress that is sponsored by almost every Democrat in Congress that supports and expands the power of police unions. And that's something that right now people are particularly folks on the left, folks who care about police violence, are not feeling that at all. Right. So it's really pushing them and exposing, I think, some divisions within the party around this issue, because, you know, up to this point, there has not been a consensus within the Democratic Party to really take on some of these systemic changes that protesters have demanded, even in, you know, very liberal cities. I mean, you look at what's happening in New York City, you look at what's happening in big cities across the country, and folks are not happy with their leadership. So, again, this is something that can affect Democrats and could, you know, result in either two things. Either they rise to the challenge and begin to talk differently about this issue and take on some of the issues that they have not taken on to date, or which has its own set of risks, because as they do that, that might alienate some folks who are in like the Rust Belt, white voters. At the same time, if they don't take those actions, it'll be very difficult for them to make a strong case, particularly to younger people and folks of color, that they would fundamentally change some of the systemic issues that have been highlighted by these incidents.
That's a good point, Sam. Nate and Claire, would you say that this is an issue that unites Republicans and divides Democrats?
Well, the idea that that in more local or state politics, Democrats have a harder time talking in maybe the full-throated progressive or left way that a lot of their constituents would want them to is really true. Like, let's take New York City and Bill de Blasio for an example. Last night, the Sergeants Benevolent Association Twitter account tweeted out and then deleted a tweet that was basically kind of, how can de Blasio, you know, be an effective leader when his object-hurling daughter is part of the protesters? The idea that the Sergeants Benevolent Association felt okay tweeting that out, I think, is indicative of the power that they hold within the city. De Blasio's initial response about some of the use of force was condemned by people who used to be in his administration. And he did it, I think, in part because he's had a lot of problems with the police union in New York. You know, there was this kind of notorious incident where they turned their back on him. And you know, police unions are some of the strongest unions left, right? And I think in a lot of cities and states, there's tricky politics for Democrats involved. So that's kind of the local part of it. But I think nationally, I mean, Joe Biden's in an interesting sort of sticky situation where obviously the primary pushed him. He won the primary because he was pushed by South Carolina and Black voters. You saw the first time he basically emerged from his basement was to talk to Black voters this weekend. He's at a church today in Delaware talking to Black leaders. He obviously feels the need to be proactive on this, not to just sort of sit back and let Trump fill the air. But I do think there's this real political danger for Biden, for the conversation about these protests to become about Antifa and the radical left, which is why I brought that up earlier, which is why Trump and the Trump campaign are kind of steering the conversation there, right? That this is violence fomented by the left. Joe Biden is supporting the left. This is part of his constituency. Biden does face this kind of problem where, you know, we can get into whether or not you need those white voters in the Midwest, or is it all about turnout of Black constituencies? We've had that conversation. We can continue to have it. But I think it exists that Joe Biden does feel some sense that he can do outreach to white Obama Trump voters. And he probably does feel the need for some he probably feels pressure to handle that in a dexterous way, right? How do you talk to white people who might be sympathetic to the idea of peaceful protest, sympathetic to the idea that George Floyd died in a way that was inhumane and unjust, but also they might say, but I don't approve of looting. Why are you burning these churches? You know, I saw a lot of DC reporters talking about this church burning last night in DC. Now, people on the left would say, who cares? It's a church, it's a building, people are dying. But on the other hand, you see a lot of Americans who say, well, we can't condone looting. And I think Biden, in his statements, and you saw this with Obama's statements, those Democratic politicians have to walk this really nuanced line of understanding the motivations and the anger on the left, but also not wanting to seem too far out there, not to accede to the line that they are, yes, supporters of the Antifa position. So it's this kind of sticky wicket that is both locally, issues-wise, complicated for Democrats because of police unions, because of all that stuff, but also nationally because of this narrative about the radical left, right, and violence in America.
Yeah, I think that's a really great description of those conflicts. On the flip side, Nate, would you say that this is something that unites Republicans? And maybe what I'm getting at here is there's an academic study that was done based off of elections in the 60s that said peaceful protests in your area can lead to an increase in the Democratic vote share, and violence and rioting close to your county or whatever will lead to an increase in Republican vote share. Essentially saying that there's a direct line between what happens in the streets and what happens in the ballot box when it comes time for elections. Do you find that research convincing, Nate?
I mean, look, we're all dealing with small sample sizes, so it's hard to know. Look, I do think the most troubling thing for Democrats is the poll I said earlier, that more people see these as violent riots and not peaceful protests. And again, the answer is there are peaceful protests and there are also some degree of riots, and like how much those overlap is a complicated question. But I don't necessarily buy that the average American in a suburb or something, the average white American in a suburb necessarily is gonna see this as like a movement to kind of peacefully end police brutality. On the other hand, they're going to see examples of police behaving very brutally, right? I mean, that's one big difference between now and 1968 or whatever, right? Is in 1968, you do have news cameras there and you have famous or infamous moments caught on film. But I don't know if you have Twitter and Facebook, and like every day it seems like I wake up and there are like six or seven really terrible instances of police behaving very violently with provocation that might seem minimal. I wonder how that would change public awareness potentially. You know, on the other hand, you know, look, all kind of models assume there's some minimum level of competence among political leaders in responding to things. And like, I mean, Trump has kind of literally apparently gone into like a bunker and is tweeting and stuff like that. But there's like ineffective leadership. It's another thing if there's like seems to be no leadership whatsoever from Trump. To the extent he's trying to exploit the message, it's actually a little bit weird because he's saying, okay, these are outside agitators, Antifa or whatever, right? You know, if you're being purely cynical, is that the message you want? Or do you want to say that, no, these protesters don't have a legitimate point? He's kind of conceding that they do, which in some sense is progress. But it's just, I'm just saying, like, I think especially given that Trump has trouble stringing together a coherent strategy and kind of works off instinct to, and even that kind of puts it generously, I think, in some ways. I think it's a little chaotic. It might be kind of overtaken by events on the ground, and I'm not sure if either party's message discipline is going to survive the fact that, look, one thing I worry about is, like, you're going to see what happens if you have, like, a police vehicle actually, as has happened in some places, drive into a crowd of protesters, but what if there are a mass number of casualties as a result, right? What if there is extreme violence toward police officers, on the other hand, right? It just kind of seems like things are spinning in ways that are very hard to predict. And Trump, I guess, is a disadvantage in some sense of being the incumbent and also someone who, by the way, from voters, out of every issue, how do you feel Trump's doing on this issue? The issue where we got like the very lowest grades of all, even pre- all of this was on race relations, right? People do not trust him, even people who approve him overall, to be a healer of racial divides in the country. And so he probably has more room to get himself in trouble with anything he says or does, especially given that he's not very disciplined, than another politician might have. So I don't know. I think it's very hard to predict.
Yeah, Sam, wrapping up here, given that you described the conflict within the Democratic Party, do you see a united Republican Party on this, or do you see one that is somewhat conflicted between voters who, well, we already mentioned this in the YouGov poll, that there are clearly some Republican voters who see problems with what the police did in Minneapolis. So is it fair to say now that there are, you know, looting and arson, that they'll be united against that? Or do you see a coalition that's more divided?
I think they're also in a difficult position, because I think with this incident, when we're talking about George Floyd and the video, it has been pretty much impossible for anybody to come out and try to defend the officers or say that that was a legitimate use of force. So, and the Republicans acknowledge that. Even Lindsey Graham has called for an investigation into this issue and solutions around it. Even, you know, we had Mitt Romney who has spoken out against it. We've seen really across the political spectrum, including Republicans that I never would have expected to take this stance, say that there's a real problem. So if they don't address the problem that they've already acknowledged, that everybody acknowledges now, that it is unambiguous, then I think that also puts them in a position of that is a weak position, because they don't have any solution to prevent this from ever happening again, which means that even if they, you know, I don't know, send in the National Guard and the military and try to sort of violently suppress this rebellion, I don't think that that will, first of all, that causes a whole range of other issues and violence and the videos that you talked about, Nate, where protesters are being brutalized by the police, that amplifies all of that. But it also, it doesn't speak to the core conditions and the underlying incident that created this mess, which if you don't have a solution for that, it's hard to convince voters that you would be an effective person to deal with that issue over the next 4 years.
Yeah. Well, it's been, I guess, a historic and difficult week. Does anybody have any closing thoughts as we wrap up this podcast? I'm sure we will be talking about this again very soon.
I mean, I think we always end up, the purpose of our site and the podcast, and I think the purpose of these protests, is to talk about these issues like in a very broad, like both the politics of it and the broad societal thing, but also, I mean, the video is pretty terrible. I think, you know, the idea that it has kind of like united people speaks to the fact that it's like a pretty emotional 9-minute watch. And I think that there are very few things that make Americans agree on anything. And I think the fact that this video and this killing has done that is sort of terrible, but also just like, I mean, I'm bumbling this, but saying like, this is also just like a personal tragedy. Like this, you know, people turn into kind of names and I think that's the thing that a lot of people are grappling with too in these protests, is this is like a person who, you know, tried to allegedly spend a $20 bill and it was counterfeited. And in the middle of like a economic crisis, I think a lot of people are just sort of hit by the emotion of it. So we have spent a lot of this talking about like the broader things, but I mean, the video itself and his death itself is pretty, just pretty horrific on the small incident. So I just didn't want to let that go without saying it.
Yeah.
I think if you listen to this podcast, we talk a lot about kind of reversion to the mean, right? And something happens, people expect it to be a new trend, and then instead it reverts back to some version of how it was before. This is one case where I'm not sure if that applies, in part because of the way the various stories mesh together. Where it's not like when the protests die down or the violence dies down, it's not like we're going back to normal. We're going back to this kind of strange world in which many, many people are unemployed. Many, many things that people enjoy doing or don't enjoy doing but count on doing, like going to school, are not open. And so it's like kind of not like we're going to like forget about this and in 2 weeks and things seem normal. And it's also kind of maybe, you know, it's not necessarily like people who were involved in the protests have a job that they would get back to on Monday morning that they might in times when they wouldn't be working from home or might be now unemployed or something, right? You know, and you add to that the layer of Trump, like kind of not really even trying to restore equilibrium or balance and in some ways antagonizing things. And like, you know, I don't know. I mean, I think this is going to be weird for a long time, potentially.
Yeah, I mean, I almost want to hear John Dickerson talk about just the historic role of like Trump just as in the job of president being quiet this weekend, I do think is significant. You know, even if, Nate, as you say, like he's a racially divisive person, but which I think we all kind of, I think most Americans understand that. But the idea that the president, after 4 days of violence, hadn't said anything publicly outside of Twitter is just like historically kind of crazy.
Yeah. And there is like, I was in researching for the show, was looking back on, if you do look at riots in the U.S. historically, how long do they persist for? It actually is like to me, it was a surprisingly consistent length of time, which is maybe up to 4 or 5 or 6 or 7 days, but generally not longer than that. But again, you know, you don't have forces who, I mean, you do rather have forces who are trying to pull things together and not fracture them further, right? I do also worry about like all this rhetoric about outside agitators. And this, by the way, this is a capital B, capital S, both sides kind of thing, because you did also have Democrats and kind of left-wing groups kind of saying, okay, these are actually white nationalists that are coming in. Meanwhile, you have Trump literally saying it's Antifa, right? And probably there's some of all of the above, right? I don't know. But I do very much worry that, like, talking about outside agitators encourages outside agitators to come in, because they feel like I have to fight the other outside agitators now. And when you study people who have studied unrest around the world, they say that's usually a bad sign when that type of rhetoric starts to take place. That makes things a lot more complicated. So I wish I had more optimistic thoughts to conclude this, but like I don't. And then there's this whole kind of other question about like, what's this do to the politics of the lockdown? What's it do to coronavirus transmission itself? So yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you know, this is, you know, in full disclosure, I was up until like 5 in the morning last night because, you know, a very, very close friend got arrested, who wasn't even at the protest in New York City, for being outside near where a protest was taking place. They arrested her, locked her in the One Police Plaza, the NYPD building, the jail. So I had to go down there to try to get them out. And they just grouped everybody into this big sort of pen. They were in this line. There was no social distancing at all. You know, it was, I think the effect that this could have on the pandemic is scary to think about. And that will take on its own political implications that both sides will probably try to exploit. One side blaming the protesters, the other side obviously blaming the president's inadequate response to the pandemic in the first place and the police response, which has exacerbated it. So again, like this is there are a lot of unknowns, and I think it remains to be seen what happens. I do think that there is this opportunity at the same time, because there is such consensus around the injustice that happened, that this injustice is real, that it exists. And I think to the extent that sort of collectively we can focus on that, that might lead to a better outcome.
All right. Well, I guess maybe a little bit of an optimistic note to end on after some pessimistic ones, but let's leave things there for now. So thank you so much for joining us today, Sam.
Thank you.
And thank you, Nate.
Thank you, Galen.
And thank you, Claire.
Thanks, Galen.
My name is Galen Druk. Tony Chow is in the virtual control room. You can get in touch by emailing us at podcasts@538.com. You can also, of course, tweet at us with questions or comments. If you're a fan of the show, leave us a rating or review in the Apple Podcast Store or tell someone about us. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you soon.